Well, hey everyone, I hope you're well. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. And today we have a very special interview with Mike Campbell, member of the Heartbreakers, songwriting partner of the late Tom Petty, and chieftain of the band The Dirty Knobs. And we're going to talk a lot about vinyl records, recording, and more. Mike was part of Tom Petty's band before it was even called Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. He was with Mudcrutch, an early version of the Heartbreakers, who released a few very hard to find and highly collectible records. Now, we're going to talk about those today. We're also going to cover many pivotal points in the career of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, including the early battles with record companies, what's in the Heartbreakers' vault, what's happening with all the master tapes, what outtakes are still to see the light of day, the posthumous Wildflowers and All the Rest project, playing with Johnny Cash, and heaps more. Plus, you are all invited to an album release party. This Friday, November 20th, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, a free album release party and a live streaming show from the Dirty Knobs from the Troubadour in Hollywood. This is all to benefit Neva, a group which is working hard to save the live stages and secure a future for live music. Now, obviously, with COVID and everything, one of the hardest hit businesses is the live entertainment industry. So help out Neva so a musical future awaits all of us once the pandemic is over. That's the Dirty Knobs Reckless Abandon album release party. You're all invited this Friday, November 20th. I'll put links in this episode page, or you could head over to facebook.com/thedirtyknobs. And here's a real quick shout out to our show sponsor, groovewasher.com. If you have records, you need a record cleaner. So get the best record cleaner in the world, the Groove Washer. Now, whether you're a hobbyist with a handful of records or a mega record collecting nerd with a bathtub full of vinyl, the Groove Washer has record cleaning kits just for you. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record shop or go to groovewasher.com, order direct, and get a discount when you use promo code VINYLGUIDE10 at checkout. That's the Groove Washer at groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10. And another quick shout out to show sponsor AudiophileUSA.com, the online used record shop that ships worldwide and only sells excellent and near mint vinyl records. No more record roulette when the mail comes. Know that you're getting a beautiful vinyl pressing from AudiophileUSA.com. With nearly 50,000 titles in stock, AudiophileUSA.com ships directly to your door no matter where you are in the world. Search their inventory at AudiophileUSA.com and find your holy grail. And finally, if you enjoy this podcast, check out our other episodes of The Vinyl Guide on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and more. Past podcast interviews include the likes of Josh Fries, Ron Carter, Matt Cameron of Pearl Jam, Stephen Van Zandt of the E Street Band, Beb Bevan of ELO, John Carter Cash, Bob Lefsetz, and more. Heaps of other interviews, all available when you subscribe to The Vinyl Guide for free on your favorite podcast app. And with that, let's start our conversation with Heartbreaker and Dirty Knob, Mr. Mike Campbell.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Mike Campbell.
Yes, it is. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. How are you?
I'm good. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Sydney, Australia. Even though I sound Californian, I've been here long enough that this country is now my own.
Cool. I love Sydney.
Yeah, it's a good place to be. How's Los Angeles today?
It's beautiful. We got blue skies. It's not too hot. Nice.
The fires still giving you guys trouble over there?
There may be some up north, but I think it's calmed down mostly. We didn't get it down here in L.A.
Got it. Okay. Well, good for you. All right. So I think we've got nearly an hour here to talk about records and the new Knobs album. So you got your tea or coffee or anything you need?
I actually do have some coffee, and I'm filling up my pipe as we speak.
Very good. All right. So let's have fun with it. All right. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we welcome guitarist, producer, songwriter, and guy who probably wrote at least one song you've had in your head this week, Mr. Mike Campbell. Are you ready to talk records today?
I love records.
You do. That's a fantastic place to start. First off, are you a record collector? Do you have a vinyl collection?
You know, I have a healthy vinyl collection. I'm not a crazy collector, but over the years, I had to build a cabinet for them. So I guess that qualifies me as a vinyl collector.
Okay, so what's the difference between healthy and crazy in your mind?
Well, I guess I had a friend who had his whole house from wall to wall was records, stacks of shelves, and he had them alphabetized. I'm not quite that big. I have just a little cabinet, but I don't know, several hundred maybe, but they're just sort of stacked sort of in alphabetical order.
Okay. You could find what you need when you need it.
I hope so, yeah.
Okay. And are these records that you've collected over time? You know, are these the ones that some of them even maybe made their way from Gainesville, or are these more recent releases?
Yeah, these are records from my whole life. You know, I haven't looked at them lately. I was going to go through them soon and see how out of order they are. But yeah, they're from my whole life, starting back when I was a kid and could only afford to buy one record a year to right up through my adult years.
Hmm. So it sounds like as a boy, there wasn't enough money to have a whole lot of investment in music. How did you get your records?
Well, I would save up a nickel and dime here and there, and I'd go down. Back then, I think my first album I bought was Hard Day's Night. And back then, you could get the mono for $1 or stereo for $2. So I think I got the mono version, and I started with that.
That's a good place to start. So that album was your first record. Did you have 45s before then, or did you go straight to the long play?
I think I might have bought a 45. Let me think back. That's the first record I remember is A Hard Day's Night. And then I had the Beach Boys album, Shutdown Part 2, I think it was called. Those were my two favorite bands at the time. And then I picked up an Animals album along the way and the Stones. You know, the 60s was my time. And there were so many great bands back then. And buying a record was a big deal, you know. Was it like it is now? You know, you'd get a record and it was like, you know, this is like a religious experience. I'm going to listen to it side one, side two from start to finish, you know.
Were you swapping records back and forth, trading with your friends, or did you tend to hang
out? Yeah, I did some of that. I think I had traded a friend of Beach Boys for a Beatles record at some point.
Was there a particular shop that you went to that sold records? Because I know back then they would be in drug stores and not necessarily just devoted record stores, but they could be in a...
Oh, you're right. Places. I think I got my records at the drugstore. They'd have a little corner with, maybe 10 feet wide of records, and you could thumb through those and get them at the Rexall Drugs or whatever back in Jacksonville.
Yeah. My local back in the day was in Missouri at Skaggs Drugstore. And the 45 rack was like a religious experience.
You know, I just remember my first 45 was She Loves You on Swan Records. She Loves You on one side and I'll Get You on the other side.
Wow. Okay. That's somewhat collectible. You think you still have that in the cabinet?
I think I still have it up there. Yeah.
All right. Well, if you ever fall on hard times, you know, there's always that.
And I'm lucky enough right now, I think it's closed because of the pandemic, but like a block from my house, there's a vintage record store. Just has thousands and thousands of records.
Ooh.
Recently, I would go down there and just, you know, have a look and pick up a few things. Usually, I'd end up buying old records again, you know.
Yeah. Now, going to record stores, obviously, pandemic aside, is that something you would do on a pretty regular basis?
Relatively regular. I mean, I've been so busy once things started happening that I didn't have as much free time to go record shopping. But I would go on tour sometimes. You know, if I passed a record store, somebody would usually tip me off. Oh, there's a great vintage record store on, you know, on so-and-so street. I would go around there and have a look. Mm-hmm. On a day off, that's a great thing to do on tour. And I took a little portable record player with me. Even on the last tour with Fleetwood Mac, I took a little portable record player. And I just have a handful of albums in my drawer, and I'd pull them out and play them.
Wow. Okay. So even that sounds like it's not exactly convenient to do. So it sounds like you really do favor the record format.
Well, I do if I really want to have an experience, you know, an aural experience, I'll put on a vinyl record. But unlike everybody else, I'm usually in a hurry, you know, and I pick up stuff, you know, streaming or whatever, or on the XM radio I listen to a lot when I'm driving. Mm-hmm. But if I really want to listen to something and tune into what's going on, I'll put on a record and just take time and listen to it. You know?
Is there a record that you would love to have as part of your collection? Something that you've always been on the search for?
No, not per se. I tend to, I picked up most of the records I liked over the years. I do tend to go toward the blues section nowadays, look for John Lee Hooker or Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf. I like finding those records, or Slim Harpo, Jimmy Reed, I love. Mm-hmm. I like finding those on vinyl.
I'm assuming the Beatles is probably your ground zero. They're the one that made you want to play guitar?
Yeah, the Beatles, Elvis, Stones, Chuck Berry, that era.
In terms of enjoying the music, are you a completist? I mean, do you look to have every album, like let's say John Lee Hooker, are you looking to just for a few pockets here and there, or are you looking for more of a complete works?
Oh, no, I'm just a random record buyer. Mm-hmm. I don't try to get a whole, you know, every record by every artist I like, but I just pick stuff up as I find it. Oh, this is good. I never heard this one. I'll grab it, you know.
Now, in the early 70s, you formed the band Mudcrutch.
Uh-huh.
There was a single, Up in Mississippi, that I believe you guys self-produced. Is that right?
That's right. Our first quote-unquote record. It really was a record only, you know.
Yeah.
And it was on vinyl, of course. It was, and we went down to Miami Criteria Studios. We had saved, actually a friend of ours was a farmer, and he had a good year and gave us $800 to go make a record. So we recorded the single, printed up, you know, a couple of hundred of them, and sent them around to the radio stations ourselves. You know, it was all self-produced. And then one day, we were living in Gainesville. One day we heard, they're playing your record up in Lake City, which is about a two-hour drive.
Hmm.
We all got in the car and drove up to Lake City and sat around at the burger joint until our record came on the radio, and we all started screaming, you know. It was a big deal.
So do you remember how many were pressed up? You said a couple hundred. Is it yeah. 200, 300, something like that? Okay.
Yeah, something like that.
And it was on this label called Pepper Records. Why was the name Pepper selected?
Our friend Gerald had a pepper farm, and he had a windfall year, and he was real close friends with our drummer. So he kind of gifted us the money to go make our record.
Wow. Okay. And you named the label after his farm.
Right.
Okay. And what was the thought of that record? Like when you pressed it up, you know, started sending them to radio stations, you wanted to try to get the attention of a record company. What was the intent?
Well, we just wanted to get heard. You know, we are really just starting out. We were very green, but we emulated our heroes that we heard on the radio, the Beatles and Stones and all that. And we just had a dream, you know, it's kind of a pipe dream, really, at the time that we would ever get a record together or get something on the radio or ever do anything, you know, for real that was successful. But we were just young kids, you know. I do remember when we got our single that you talked about, the Pepper Records single, and we sent it to the local radio stations in Gainesville, and they would have, once a week, they would have a request. People would call in to request their record that they wanted to hear that day. It was usually Beatles or Stones. And we had all our friends get on the phone. We sat there on the phone ourselves and kept calling and calling and calling, requesting our record, you know. We finally did play it once. Then they caught on to us. Like, didn't you just call 5 minutes ago? No, that wasn't me.
Yeah, if you did make a career in music, you may have made it in marketing.
There you go.
So what did it feel like to you for a young Mike Campbell and the rest of the band to be able to have their music finally on vinyl record? That must have been a huge milestone.
It was the beginning of our journey. You know, we realized that you can make records, and you know, I made us wanted to make better records. You know, it was a learning experience, but it's kind of charming for what it was at the time. But yeah, it just definitely inspired us to just keep trying to get better.
And do you still have a copy or two of that Pepper record single?
Once again, I'm going to have to go look through my closet. I think I do.
Okay, you know, that's highly collectible at this point. Yeah.
I guess it is. I think I saw somewhere that they were kind of rare. So I should probably see if I have one. Maybe I could unload it for some cash.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, those records go for somewhere between $1,200 and $2,000 now.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, if you'd have told me that back in the day, I would have shit my pants.
Do you remember having like still boxes that you guys couldn't move back in the day?
Oh, yeah. They were stacked in our room. They're like, what are we going to do with these? Well, someday we'll, you know, give them away or sell them or something.
Did you sell them at gigs? Do you try that angle?
You know, we must have. We must have had some records. We have records available if you want over here in the corner. But I don't really remember that too much.
So that was your first single. Right now, Discogs has you associated with an early Meatloaf album. Is that right? Or is that a miss?
No. Mike Campbell?
Yes.
No. There's another session musician from New York named Mike Campbell. Played on a lot of New York records, and that must be him. I had nothing to do with Meatloaf.
Okay. So it didn't add up, but I just wanted to check. Now, after that initial single, there was the move to L.A., and then Mudcrutch put out a few singles on Shelter Records.
Mm-hmm.
What was the conversation like around those records? Again, just testing the waters, trying to get some interest in the band?
Yeah, we're just trying to get something going, you know, trying to get a little interest, maybe get a little exposure so we could get better gigs or any gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had Denny Cordell liked our demo tape at Shelter Records, and he brought us out and kind of took us under his wing and directed us a little bit and helped us learn how to record in the studio. And that those sessions, you know, went through some changes, and Mudcrutch fell apart. And then eventually Tom got some good songs, and we got the Heartbreakers, some guys from Florida that just happened to be in L.A. We met them all at a session one night, and Tom said, well, let's record with these guys. He didn't want to do a solo record with a bunch of session players.
Mm-hmm.
So the band was born, and the rest is history, I guess.
One of the interesting periods, and obviously your career is, and experiences are so vast, I'm just going to have to hit some of the collectible pockets here and there.
Cool.
But when it comes to things like your demo tapes or the tapes that were the master tapes, do you guys know where all those are, especially those early recordings? Are those accounted for?
Yeah, we do. They're in a vault. A lot of them were on 8-track.
Mm-hmm.
And the first couple of tracks, or some of the tracks on the first record were on 8-track. Some of them were on 16-track. But we have them in a vault somewhere.
Okay. So everything's accounted for. Nothing was in some absurd fire or anything. They're all somewhere.
No.
Safe.
No.
Okay. Well, that's good. In 1978, I believe there was the record label that you're on, Shelter, was sold to ABC.
Mm-hmm.
And let me know if I go off the story here. And Tom and the group refused to be part of that sale.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you were proved victorious. But at the time, it sounds like it was a pretty risky move. Were you nervous about that?
Oh, yeah. We were living hand to mouth, you know. And to Tom's credit, who was the leader of the band, and our manager, Tony, I think we had two records out on Shelter Records, and then Shelter Records was struggling, so they sold their whole thing over to ABC Records without telling us, you know, and then we found a loophole there that, you know, you can't really do that to an artist. You can't just sell their stuff without their permission. So we didn't really want to be lumped in on ABC Records. We figured we'd get lost in the shuffle, and we figured that was an opportunity if we could wait it out to just refuse to record. Like, we don't agree with this deal. We're not going to give you any more records. Of course, that was like saying, you know, we're not going to have any money for a while, which ended up to, I think, like a year or more. So what we did is we went out on a thing called the lawsuit tour. And we just went out and did some small touring just so we could pay our rent and waited it out. And then eventually we got permission to sign a new deal with MCA.
Mm. And that's when you went to Backstreet.
Yeah, and it was risky. I mean, you know, I'm saying it was, you know, hand to mouth back then. We were just scuffling along, hoping for a break, you know.
Yeah.
But to Tom's credit, you know, he said, no, we need to stand up to these people, and we have an opening here for a legal case, and we can't let them bully us around. You know, we're going to stand on our rights, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way he was. He was great like that.
That seems to be a very constant thread in the story of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. Tom always standing up for the fans, not letting ticket companies charge too much.
Yeah.
I believe Hard Promises was nearly called $8.99 as a measure to prevent the record company from charging fans more. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. It was right around the time when the record companies decided to raise the prices of records once again without asking us. And we said no, you know, because we didn't want to. We figured that, you know, it was good for the fans. We figured $8.98 was enough for the record, and they wanted to push it up to whatever it was. And we stood up, and we did that through our whole career, you know, like you said, with ticket prices and with the golden circle seats at the gigs. We would not let the rich people buy out the seats in the front. You know, we would keep real people down in the front of the shows. And we, Tom and us, we fought that demand all the time.
I get the impression also that Tom was a bit of a vinyl collector as well. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah, same as me. You know, we bought records. And we, you know, as soon as we got more money, we bought guitars too. It's like we were committed to the records and the guitars and the whole dream.
Even to the point to where, I believe on, was it Full Moon Fever, where he has a track that's specifically for CD listeners. Hello, CD listeners. This is where the vinyl record owner will flip the record. So we'll give you an extra moment here.
Right. Oh, CD listeners. Yeah. That was kind of funny. But yeah, there was a transition from vinyl to CD at one point. And, you know, we were just calling attention to the fact that, you know, don't forget about your records.
And in the Into the Great Wide Open, I believe he also said, hello, cassette listeners. He had a special track just for the tape.
Yeah, he was tape funny hits. That way.
So there was really an affinity toward the physical form media music in the history of the band. Was it important for every album to be sequenced with vinyl record or other formats in mind?
There kind of was. Yeah, we grew up on that, you know, side one, side two, and a story that you play six songs, you take a breath, you got to get up and go over and turn the record over. And then you take the second side and you try to sequence it so that there's an arc of a story and an experience from start to finish. Like, it's much like a concert where it builds and peaks and has soft moments and then ends with a bang, you know. And we always thought in terms of side one, side two, and pretty much to the end, even though, you know, that became irrelevant at some point. With all the CDs and of course now it's all streaming. The CDs are already like obsolete.
I can't give those away.
I remember when CDs first came out, they didn't sound good. They sounded tinny, and you know the analog didn't have the transfer converters from analog to digital together very well, and it was a much inferior sound to a vinyl. And as the years went on, the CD improved their converters, and it got pretty good, where they sounded almost as good as the vinyl.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your duties as, you know, member of the band and production quite often, increasingly as it became, were you also part of the mastering process?
Yeah, I was on the team. You know, we'd go down to the mastering and work on that together. But ultimately, it was usually Tom's decision, you know, about if this is done or not, you know. But I was kind of there as the co-captain, like, what do you think? You know, and I, you know, say my piece, and if he agreed with me, he'd go along with it, you know, which he usually did. We usually saw things the same way.
You were the consigliere.
There you go. Somebody else heard recently. Yeah. Robert Duvall guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Tom Hayden. I love that.
Oh, Tom, yeah.
Now, when you were presenting music to Tom, written many of the key songs we all love. Refugee, Don't Do Me Like That. There's probably, I would imagine, another half dozen songs on those tapes that you played and he didn't gravitate towards. Have you ever revisited those songs? Do you still have those tapes?
You know, it's funny you would say that because I'm right now in the process of going through all my analog catalog, which I have shelves in my studio in the lounge up top, and there's just 2-inch tape from wall to wall. And I'm going through those tapes now and having my tech transfer them over to digital to save them, and also so I can revisit them and listen to them. I've listened to a few, and I was surprised to find a couple of little gems in there already. So it'll be nice to follow through on that process.
Yeah, okay. Are you having to bake the tapes? Are you having to treat them differently?
Oh, yeah. I bought a baker, got an oven, got a good deal in the oven, and he's got a system down where he bakes four and then transfers them, and while he's doing that, he bakes four more. So it's going to be a month or two. I mean, there's no urgency, but he's working, and when he has free time, he just comes in and dives into it. And but in a month or so, I'll have them all transferred and safe.
I know there's been several compilations and anthologies of the work of the Heartbreakers. Is there much more left in the vault?
Well, there's some left. There's lots of live stuff, which I'm looking forward to. There's a live at the Fillmore in 1997. I think will be our next project. And each record had a few handful of songs that were left off for whatever reason. So I'm sure with time we'll go through and try to dig out anything that might be of interest to the fans.
Mm-hmm. Is it a bit of a struggle emotionally now to go through that material?
It is. I mean, it was. The Wildflowers thing was very emotional because it's still very fresh. The grieving process is huge for a loss like that. And, I went in with the engineer and earmarked, the stuff that I thought he should mix. And there were times when I just would have to leave the room. I just couldn't hear his voice right then. But I also enjoyed it because the music was good and it was nice to hear some of his demos that he had never shared before. So it was both those things. It was fun and inspiring, but also kind of heartbreaking.
Mm. Now, I understand that after the tour, he was starting to plan a bit of a Wildflowers tour and reissue of that material. How much of that was laid out, and how much did you and the others have to interpret to try to fill in those pieces?
Well, it was really just brainstorming. We didn't have a specific timetable on it, but we just were throwing around the idea, the concept of doing. The idea was Tom came up with. We were talking about, every tour we do, it's getting to be, it's great, but we're playing a lot of the same songs every night because people want to hear those same songs. And he's thinking, wouldn't it be great to just feature one album and play only the songs from that one album and not play all the other hits, And he thought Wildflowers would be good for that because, first of all, at the beginning it was a double album, so there's lots of material. And his idea was to do theaters, with a nice production, and do just songs from that album and maybe have guest singers come out and do certain songs along the way to make it a different kind of experience. And that, talking about it, that's as far as we got, really. Mm. It was next thing on the plate that we probably were going to get a little more serious about planning it out, but we didn't get quite that far.
Now, I understand the original track listing, the double album that he originally presented, it wasn't found. No one knows the original track listing which he originally envisioned. Is that right?
I think that's right. Yeah, there was Rick and I and Tom had a rough running order of the double album. It's very rough, and we hadn't finalized it yet because we still weren't really sure it should be a double album. Yeah. But we had that many songs. And then as that worked out, the record company suggested it might be wise to just do a single album first and save the other stuff for another project. And so once we made that decision, Tom focused in on sequencing one album out of all the songs, and that's the way it came out. But no, I don't think there exists a double album sequence anywhere. Nobody's been able to find it.
All right. Now, Wildflowers was made, I believe, around the same time that you guys started playing with Johnny Cash. How did that relationship come up? Was it through Rick Rubin?
Yes, it was. I remember being in the studio working on Wildflowers with Rick, and I was a huge Johnny Cash fan. I mean, those were some of the first records. My dad was a huge fan, and my dad would play the records all the time, and I knew him really well. And I remember saying to Rick, he was going to start a record company, and I remember telling him, he mentioned Johnny Cash, and I said, you got to do that. He's like an American treasure, And so he ended up signing him to his new label, and I was lucky enough to come in and help record a lot of the acoustic things with Johnny. So that's kind of how, and it was around the same time. Or kind of, it overlapped, and as Wildflowers finished, we went into the Johnny Cash stuff.
Oh, so you actually recommended Johnny Cash to Rick Rubin, or at least steered him in that direction a bit.
He endorsed the idea and kind of said, if you do that, that's, somebody should do that, and you'd be the right guy to do it. And if you want me to, get involved, I'd be happy to.
So there you are. You were his consigliere.
I am the consigliere to the world.
Now, recording with Johnny Cash, I'm assuming at that time, I think he was well into his 70s, probably had to limit the studio time. What were those days structured like?
Well, you're right. He was still in, he had a lot of energy, but he would get tired throughout the day. So we'd start around noon or one. And work real hard, for 3 or 4 hours. Then we might take a break, and then we might just break for the night, or we might come back and do another hour or so, and then come back the next day. It was a relatively casual schedule, but when we were in there, we worked real hard.
Mm. And from what I understand, towards the end, when Johnny knew his time was growing quite short, he became a bit of a workaholic. Is that how you recall it?
Yeah, well, he always was, but it became very intense because he kind of got this attitude that, you know, I want to record as much as I can while I'm still here, because I don't know how much longer I'll be here. So there was an intensity about it and a commitment, you know.
Mm. Understanding your history and the various artists you work with, it sounds like at some point you and Tom and the other Heartbreakers would have had to have a conversation, almost a rule, about playing with other artists outside the Heartbreakers. What was the general agreed rule in terms of that?
There was no rule.
No?
I mean, we were free to do what we wanted, but what I wanted to do was play with the Heartbreakers. I mean, Ben Mott, God bless him, he was so good. He got calls all the time to do sessions, and he played on tons of records that we weren't involved with. And occasionally I would do a project that wasn't with Tom, but all I really wanted to do was just work within the band and with Tom, because we had such a great relationship. And I was free to do that if I so chose, but, you know, I did some sessions, but I didn't enjoy it as much as working with my own band.
Mm. So there wasn't a, you know, I need to give someone a heads up about this thing that I'm considering doing.
Only time that came up was when I started getting my little Dirty Knobs band together. Mm-hmm. And I started playing clubs around town and stuff. And when I first started out, and it's still really, it's just for fun. And at the beginning, I had a guitar player, and I was using two of the Heartbreakers, the rhythm section, to play these little bars and stuff. But then as I got a little more serious about it, it dawned on me that, and Tom, that, you know, it's probably not good for me or anybody to have a side band with the Heartbreakers in it. You know, what's the point?
Yeah.
So I gave them back to the Heartbreakers and got another rhythm section for my band. And I had a discussion with Tom one time about, you know, I think I might want to put a record out. And he's so funny with the little band. He goes, really? And I go, he goes, why? I said, well, he said, I think it's pretty good. He said, is it great? I said, well, I don't know. I played it for a few people and they thought it was pretty good. Who? You know, and I told him a couple of producers' names. He goes, oh, they're all lying to you. And he's going, look, you know, if it's great, why don't we do it? So that we kind of came to an understanding that, and I at that point realized, you know, I don't really want to put a record out while I'm in the band with the Heartbreakers. It's just I'm competing with myself. And I didn't have that ambition, really. My main ambition was to make the Heartbreakers great. So I kind of kept my band on the back burner. So that was the only kind of unwritten agreement we had that, you know, maybe it's not a good idea for you to do a solo band while we're still, you know, trying to make the Heartbreakers happen.
I guess that would have been difficult to balance, especially if you're writing a song. Who is this for? Is it for the Heartbreakers? Is it for Dirty Knobs? Is it for someone else?
Well, I never think about that. When I'm writing, I just write. And then when it's done, I look at it and I go, of course, when I was working with Tom, I would show him everything because he's my partner. Mm-hmm. But I kept coming up with so much music. I think he was overwhelmed, but he couldn't possibly write to it all. He would pick the best ones, God bless him, and make great songs out of them. But all this other stuff was piling up. And so I slowly just decided, well, you know, he can't deal with all this. I'll just try to do them myself. And it progressed from there.
Mm. Are you still writing at the prolific level that you were in the 70s and 80s and 90s?
I am. I'm obsessed with writing. I'm a little more critical. I don't write quite as much, although I do write almost, you know, too much to hardly keep up with. But I try to, you know, to keep a higher bar, and then I don't just write any little sketch that comes to my mind. I try to make sure it's a valid idea before I go ahead and, you know, make a whole demo of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I write all the time. It's my obsession. It's my love. It's my gift. And I couldn't live without doing that.
Is there a particular rhythm you've recognized within yourself that allows you to be more prolific than if you didn't follow that routine?
Rhythm. You know, you ask a very deep question, and I love talking about songwriting, but it's very mysterious. You know, my only rhythm is just to try to always be open and have my antenna out there in case something comes to me. I can't like book the day out, okay, from, you know, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. I'm going to write. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way. I just kind of I go through my day, and if something occurs to me, you know, I go into the studio in my house and I follow the muse.
Right. And for the Dirty Knobs, you now have this record coming out November 20th,
yep.
Reckless Abandon. This is your first solo post-Tom project. What was the process for you like putting this together?
It was really easy because the band, the Dirty Noms, have been together for over a decade. Mm-hmm. And so we already are, you know, a tight band. We know how to play together. And I've been accumulating songs. So on the album, a half or more of the songs are songs we've already had around and maybe played in front of audiences here and there. And the rest of the songs were things that came up during the course of the recording. But we play really well together. And once we have the arrangement on the song, you know, we only play it once or twice. And I wanted the record to sound like we sound live. And so there's hardly any overdubs. We tried to do all the solos, you know, on the fly, on the track. Mm-hmm. So it was really, I think it'll be easy to recreate those songs because that's how we play. And it's just us playing without any bells or whistles. And it was really a joyful experience. And we had George DeCoulias, my old friend, come in and help us organize and lead us in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And it was done really quickly. Mm.
And I understand Klaus Voormann did the artwork for the album. Was that an existing piece of Klaus Voormann or of his work, or did you reach out for something bespoke for the album?
Well, you know, I've never actually met the man. I might have met him somewhere at a hotel somewhere for a second, but I don't really know him. And I was talking to my wife about the artwork, and her assistant said you should call Klaus Voormann because she used to work with him in Germany in his office years ago. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know he was still working. And she said, oh, no, he's still, you know, doing a lot of artwork. And so I said, you think he would do this? He said, well, you can ask him. So George DeCoulias sent him the record, and he liked the record. I told him that I had a rough idea of a runaway train on the front. And he came up with the logo and the cover, and I was just absolutely thrilled with what he did.
Mm, fantastic. Well, the album is absolutely wonderful. Now, I understand you're doing a live stream as well from the Troubadour on the 20th. How is the rollout for Reckless Abandon being impacted by COVID?
Well, the same as everybody, hugely. I mean, we can't tour. Mm-hmm. You know, we finished the record back in February, and we had a tour. You know, it was relatively small, medium-sized places, but it was all sold out. The record was ready to go. It was all mastered. We were ready to go, and then boom, this happened, and everything just stopped. You know, and it's affected everybody. It's affected the venues as well as the bands and the audiences. So we just had to take a step back. And BMG, the record label, has been very patient and kind with me and very supportive. And we rescheduled the tour a couple of times and kept pushing it back, you know, because Corona was not going away. And then it got to be this year, toward the end of the year, they agreed that we should go ahead and put it out without a tour because we just want to get it out there, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're really proud of it, but it'll be hard to promote it without it, you know, without being out there playing in all the cities and everything. So to help the record, and it was a tough decision to go into the Troubadour because of the medical protocol, mm-hmm. but we got really strict with it. You know, we all got tested every other day during rehearsals, and we had the place, you know, totally sanitized. Everybody wore masks. It was just the band. There was no audience. Mm-hmm. First, I didn't want to do it without an audience. I just thought, you know, what's the point? It won't have the same energy. But I finally came around that, you know, we could do it. And so there's no audience, just the band crew and some film guys. And I picked the Troubadour because it's such a beautiful place with all the history. And I played there several times. I loved the sound. And they actually approached us. They had a donor that was going to put up the money for this organization called NEVA, which is helping venues like the Troubadour all across the country to keep them alive, you know, during the pandemic. Because mm-hmm. once this is over, we're all going to want to play. And I hope those venues still exist.
Yep.
So we agreed to do it as a benefit for them, and it also is sort of a album release party for us. So we went in, played the album live, and you know, five or six extras, a couple of Heartbreaker songs and some covers. And we did it a couple of weeks ago. It's almost done, mixing and all that. And from what I hear, it sounds incredible. Mm. And so we'll have that. That will be our tour. But at least we have that. You know, we have, if you like the record, well, here's the band playing it live at the Troubadour, you know. So I'm glad we did it, and everybody survived. Nobody got sick or anything, so that was great.
Well, you do have some tour dates up on the website, which I think was incredibly refreshing to again see tour dates being posted, even though they're very deep into 2021 and perhaps even aspirational at this point. It's at least nice to be able to see those things, someone trying to make plans to move ahead.
Yeah, well, we're holding on for a miracle. We have dates in June with my friend Chris Stapleton, who plays Big Places. And he was kind enough to offer us some opening slots. And then that's in June. And then in July and August, we have our old tour, which is still sold out, and people have held their tickets. And if, you know, God willing, we're healthy by then and the world is safe, I kind of doubt it. I mean, if I had to bet, looking at the way this thing is spiking right now, it may be the end of next year, you know, before things open up enough for people to safely go to concerts. But we're going to hold those dates as long as we can, you know, to the last second. And if we have to move them back, we'll move them back. But, you know, it's got to be safe for everybody before we go back out there.
That's right. Well, you could always come over to Australia. We're starting to have live gigs again here.
Heard that in New Zealand. I wish I was a New Zealander. I could already be touring.
Now, there's things,
all of us. Oh, I'd love to go back to Australia. I had such a great time down there with the Fleetwood Mac on that last tour.
Uh-huh.
I love Sydney. I love the whole country. It's beautiful.
Right now, live music is starting to happen, but they're doing like multiple shows a night. So you can't jam 300 people into a hall. But what you can do is have two or three shows of 50 to 100. So you'll have a show at like 5 p.m. and one at 8 p.m. and maybe a late show, and people are socially distanced. You must have a mask on. But at least, I mean, that's something's better than nothing.
Oh, that's a great story. Yeah, and I know some people are doing drive-in theaters, which I'm not too keen on, where you pull up in your car and the band is on the stage. I had this goofy idea to invent like a hazmat clear plastic suit. So everybody gets, when you get your ticket, you get your suit, you zip it up and you go in and you're like in a transparent plastic suit. I think an audience full of those kind of people would look hilarious.
Yeah, or you could go like the Flaming Lips. Everyone could be in this plastic bubble.
It's kind of a similar idea, but instead of a bubble, you'd actually be in a suit so you could get more people and they could be waving their arms around and stuff and all be plastic people, you know. But, well, the point is the industry is scampering to come up with alternatives, you know, until things open up again. We're just going to keep doing what we do and find other ways to get our music out there.
So, Mike, your career and experiences been across decades, and technology has advanced from analog to digital, and now we have lossless files. How do you feel those digital formats compare to the vinyl record experience?
Well, we've covered a lot of things. I mean, all I would like to say, you know, we were talking about vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about this before this interview, the difference between listening to vinyl or listening to digital music. I mean, there is something to it, and I was trying to figure out how I could describe it, but, you know, vinyl is an organic sound, and digital is a sound, but it doesn't have there's little, you know, if you break it down, there's little minute gaps in the sound that you don't hear, but they're there. And I found with myself when I listen to, you know, and I'm like everybody, I'm in a hurry. I want to hear it on YouTube. I want to hear the song right then. So I'll just listen on a little unit of some sort, a little Bluetooth or whatever, if I'm in a hurry. But when I listen to a record, you know, a vinyl, and I put that record on, like when we got our first pressing for our record, I went into my living room, which I rarely do, and I have a nice record player in there with good speakers, and I listened to that album in there, and I tell you what, not just because it was my music, because I played some other records too, but there's something about the experience, the oral and physical experience, the graininess of the music, and that it gives you the vibrations that fit your body in a different way, I think. And that sounds kind of deep, but I really think there's something about vinyl that gives your body a more pleasant experience than listening to digital music.
I've got a bit of a theory on that. You know, you've got in analog, you've got the sine wave, right? Very smooth curve. In digital, you have the same sine wave, but it's actually, if you zoom in, it's a bunch of little steps, right?
Exactly.
And the brain has to do the math to connect those steps to make that smooth sine wave. So at least from my experience, I could listen to records all day, but I could only listen to digital music for a little while before I get a little bit tired. And I think that's because my brain is doing unconscious math in the background decoding the sound.
Absolutely right. That was what I was trying to say. And it's a scientific fact. Your brain works harder to process the music. With vinyl, it just washes over you. Brain relaxes. And the vibrations, I think, are just a little different that hit your bones. And I think you're absolutely right. It's the brain work that makes it a little more pleasurable and relaxing when you listen to a record.
Yeah. When you listen to a record, I mean, not one of your own, but maybe your own as well. As a songwriter, as a producer, someone who's spent quite a bit of their life in a studio, can you listen to it as the song, or does your brain sometimes start to dissect, oh, they punched that in there, oh, that reverb is this other? I mean, how do you separate Mike Campbell, the person who enjoys the music, from Mike Campbell listening as a producer?
That's a great question, and it's very true. I could be in the car listening to something like a Stones song. I may have heard it before, but I love it. And I'll just be listening as a listener driving down the road. God, I'm loving this. And then I'll hear something and the analytical part of my brain goes, I wonder how they recorded that guitar. You know, I wonder where they put the microphone and the drums on this song. And then you're no longer just the happy-go-lucky listener. You're the analyzer, you know, which is just fun too. But sometimes it is a struggle to just turn off that part of your brain and listen like you did before you were a musician, you know. And I don't know if you can ever get there again, but I try.
Right. Okay. So you have to almost bring yourself back down to earth and say, look, it's detach yourself.
Yeah, it's a conscious effort. Look, I don't want to analyze this record. I don't want to try to learn or pull a chord or figure out how they produced it. I just want to close my eyes, almost like meditation, turn all that off and just enjoy this music. You know, and I have to make a conscious effort of that sometimes. Mm. It's the nature of the beast.
Well, yeah, look, it's one of the reasons why I started going back to listen to a lot of jazz from the 60s, because they recorded that all in one shot. So the production was pretty straightforward, and the musicianship, there's no way I could play like these guys. So I'm not even thinking about chord structures or anything. I could do nothing but just be a passenger on that train.
You know, that's a cool point, because I do the same thing, especially on old records like jazz or blues or even the early 60s rock and roll music. It comes on and I hear the sound, and in my mind, I'm picturing the scene, because I know they're all in a room together. Mm-hmm. You know, this was not punched in or added one piece at a time. They're all, so you're hearing the vocal, so he must be over in the corner. And the acoustic bass, you know, can't be too close to the drums or it'll drown it out. You know, the guitars have to be over in the corner, and all this sound is happening in the room. And I can actually visualize how they recorded it. I can see where the mics were placed in my head, at least while I think it would have been. And I can see all the players interacting with each other. And on a lot of modern records, it's just a computer doing it all.
All right. So, Mike, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide, talking to us about vinyl and, of course, your recorded history. It's quite fascinating. And I know we only hit the tops of the waves, but I think you've answered some important questions. And hopefully you'll find a few moments to go back into your record cabinet and see if you have a copy of that Pepper record single from back in the day. I want to remind the listeners to check out The Dirty Knobs. You can go to thedirtyknobs.com. There's their new album, Reckless Abandon. It's going to be out November 20th. There's vinyl available at thedirtyknobs.com. There's going to be a live stream, which, of course, you can go to thedirtyknobs.com as well and get those links and check that out as well. Be able to see a concert. It's been a while since we've all been to a concert, and maybe quite a bit longer too. So make sure you check that out live at the Troubadour. There's vinyl copies of Reckless Abandon available. You could also listen on all the streaming services on November 20th and then grab yourself a physical copy as well. Mike, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide, mate.
I appreciate it. This was more interesting than a normal interview. I like the questions, and may vinyl music live forever.
Absolutely.
Hey, well, stay safe, and thank you for your time, too.
You got it. We'll see you next time you're down under.
All right.
All right, I hope you all enjoyed that. Wow, what a legend. Mr. Mike Campbell, formerly of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, but currently with the Dirty Knobs. And may I remind you, Reckless Abandon, out November 20th. Stream it on your phone and order the vinyl. You could try before you buy, but the album is great. I know you'll probably end up grabbing one. Plus, don't forget, you are invited to the Dirty Knobs album release party. Friday, November 20th, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm sure there's going to be replays of it as well. Head over to facebook.com/thedirtyknobs. The Dirty Knobs live streaming show and album release party from the Troubadour in Hollywood to benefit Neva. That's Friday, November 20th. Go to facebook.com/thedirtyknobs and check in there. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much to everyone who is sharing these episodes on social media,
putting them on Facebook, tweeting them out on Twitter, highlighting them in Instagram. That is a huge help. And don't forget, you could also go over to our Patreon page and help support the show. Patreon.com/vinylguide. Head over there now and you get extended interviews, early access to episodes, secret episodes, and more. That's patreon.com/vinylguide, and we thank you in advance for your support. We'll be back shortly with a brand new episode, so until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.